Dr. Ben, we're certain that from now to December of this year, we will have been able to extend the LSI throughout Kenya and in East Africa as well. Yes. But we are making progress. So I would say one Africa, one nation to everyone.
It's one Africa, one nation.
One nation.
Uhuru.
Uhuru.
Okay. Uhuru. Uhuru. You're listening to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyambinga Zimbabwe. And you just heard the conclusion of the interview done on yesterday with comrades Chernow Alpha Mba, the director of Organization of the African Socialist International, comrade Sarah Lavender Achieng, the national chair of the ASI in Kenya, and comrade Solomon Otieno, the national director of agitation and propaganda for the ASI in Kenya. Again, this is these comrades we were interviewing on yesterday from Kenya, and they've been tied in this process of consolidating the African Socialist International in East Africa. They are forces who are tied to the newly established National Committee of the ASI in Kenya. You know, and so this is an extremely significant process. You heard at the end of that interview, you know, various other comrades who are tied to that process, you know, chiming in or signing in, letting us know who they were. Want people to, you know, stay abreast on what's happening with developments in East Africa. With our comrades of the ASI there. There is, you know, it is a difficult situation on the ground there in Kenya, where the government is quite repressive and has, you know, has been known to attack forces who challenge its rule and has already, you know, made some attacks on ASI forces in the area. So we have to stay abreast on what's happening and prepared to defend our comrades there in Kenya. We're going to take a break here and come back with a presentation that was made by Comrade Louise Kinshasa, who is the Secretary General of the African Socialist International. The presentation that we're going to play was one that he had done at the first East Africa Regional Conference of the African Socialist International on April 9th and 10th. This is Africa Live here on uhururadio.com.
Red, gold, black and green. Rally round the red, gold, black and green. fucking resistance. Raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them drums in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them calling in the distance. African resistance. Now raise your fist and let's go get this. Woo-woo, that's what we fighting for. I am your brother and struggled up with inciting your hood to resistance. Don't get it twisted, we don't just ride for now. We organize and go the distance. And if it's a question of who did this, the fact is, police beatings make the streets testy like a litmus. And this is when the tide gets to turning. Guerrillas in the midst of South Side gets to burning. They learning, cause we've been organizing for a while. They yearning, the people going to ride to get what sides be concerned. If you on the wrong side of the line, cause when you selling out, they see you, cause nobody is blind. And so why? White power dangles carrots to entice us. I'll be doing all that I can to deepen the crisis. Might get me, but it'll never be done. So we want the more Africans to kill, the more come. You can hear it in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist, it's time to get this. Yo, I can hear it in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them drums in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them calling in the distance. African resistance. Now raise your fist and let's go get this.
They created a beast when they took us overseas. We was made to survive anything like killer bees. We've been through slavery plus the middle passage, separated from our roots like some ghetto bastards. But more struggle make for better masses. We in a class of our own. Worker bees destined for the throne. We fought battles unknown. Every family got a story untold. That's how we came for. So what we came for? Not to change laws. That's a lame pause. But the bank for our freedom. The only thing my people ever needed. Black power was militarily defeated. But we rising from the ashes of defeat like a phoenix. So we here like a shadow, even when you can't see us. Who wanna see us? You wanna be us? You can't deceive us. This time it came with heaters. Black.
You can hear it in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist. It's time to get this. Yo, I can hear it in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist. It's time to get this. I hear them drums in the distance. African resistance. Raise your fist. It's time to get this. I hear them calling in the distance. African resistance. Now raise your fist and let's go get this. Swear they do. 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 Swear they do.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nimbinga Zimbabwe. And up to now, we've been listening to an interview that I did on yesterday with comrades in Kenya, where the National Committee of the African Socialist International of Kenya was recently established. I was interviewing comrades Cherno Alpha Mba, who is the director of organization of the African Socialist International, as well as comrades Sarah Lavender Achieng, the national chair of the ASI in Kenya, and comrade Solomon Otieno, national director of agitation and propaganda of the ASI in Kenya. We now are going to go to a presentation that was made by Louise Kinshasa, the Secretary General of the African Socialist International, at the first East Africa Regional Conference of the African Socialist International. This presentation was made on April 9th, 2009, in Nairobi, Kenya, at the Mbotela Community Center. This is Comrade Louise Kinshasa, Secretary General of the ASI.
You know, we pay attention, we take seriously the question of theory, ideas, concept, how we think, worldview, what is in your brains. All of us here have ideas, concepts, philosophies in our brains right now. But the problem we have, 99% of African people everywhere in this world have been educated directly or indirectly by our oppressors.
Yes.
You watch TV, you listen to the radio, you listen to music, everything we do has been defined by our oppressors. As you will understand, an oppressor has no interest to educate an oppressed. If you are a slave master, you have no interest to educate the slaves to be smart,
right,
to be intelligent, to think for themselves. Because if they do, the first thing they will do is kill the slave master. That's why the question of theory is of critical importance to you and me. We must think for ourselves. We must define our own realities. We must understand the world as it really is. Because our oppressors cannot define the world as it really is. You don't see any thief, although you recognize the thief, because you know how people get money. The bigger the man, the bigger the crook. But you don't see anybody coming on the TV and say, I'm the crook. They say, I'm the member of the parliament. I'm the minister. I'm the chief of these tribes, etc. No thief go on the street and say, I'm a thief.
Right.
Arrest me. They say, you know, I'm a big person. I'm an important person. They have to cover up realities. And that is what exactly is happening to us. When we see Europe, we don't see thieves. We see developed country, because all the time they say developed country versus developing countries.
Yes.
And we refer to them as developed countries. They define themselves as civilized people,
yes,
opposed to uncivilized people. They mean us.
Yes.
That's how they do it. They define themselves in a certain way, and they do it in a way that they force us to respect who they are, to the way that, to the point that we don't even recognize the thieves on the street. And that's why theory is important. The starting point. What's the starting point? You have to explain why we are poor. Why we are powerless. You have to explain why white people are powerful, why they are wealthier, why they are richer. You have to explain these realities. And if you listen to them, they will say something that justify what they have done to us and continue to do to us. Growing up in the Congo, we were told, I'm sure they say the same thing to you, white people are powerful because in Europe it's cold. And because it's colder, it forces them to think. It makes them intelligent. I'm not sure if they say that to you as well. That's one explanation. Another explanation is that they save their money. We don't. We spend our money all the time. We don't save anything. So they brought all kinds of explanations. When we met 15th century or earlier, when he attacked Africa, Africa was not a united place. Africa was a place where you have many entities, nations, ethnies, you might call them, many kingdoms. Africa was fragmented because in the process of occupying Africa, we moved from a point where we used to be one, we became, you know, Zulu, Xhosa, Luo, Kambas, you know, Utu, etc. So when they met with us, we were on that stage. As the chairman said, they attacked us in West Africa. Kidnapping started in West Africa. But when the Portuguese and the Spanish reached what they call Congo today, people in the Congo didn't know.
Right.
The Portuguese and the Spanish and the Dutch and the English, the Danish, the Swedish that came to the Congo have been already in West Africa for over 50 years attacking African people in that part of Africa. So the intent of European was clear. Enslaved all Africa. But people in the Congo didn't know. When they moved down south to South Africa, people in South Africa didn't know that we already met in what we call Nigeria for almost 100 years. That was a weakness. Africa was not united when we met with Europe. There was no central power. There was no central leadership. And that was a weakness of Africa. The sad thing is what? It has remained so up to this time you and I are talking. Over 500 years, we have not rectified that weakness. Isn't that wrong? That's what we are confronted right now. No united, no central leadership. That's something we need to solve. So when we met, that's how it was. So Europe, and there was no words like that for you, for people from Europe. Nobody referred to them as Europeans. Nobody. They referred to that part of the world as Christendom, land of the Christians. There was no Britain as we know it today when we met. There was no France as we know it today when we met. There was no Dutch, there was no Italy. It was a group of white people organized around kings and princes, stuff like that, with no national economy as we know them today. They attacked Africa. They left Europe running away from poverty and diseases. You have to really understand that. When we met, Europe was poor.
Yes.
No universities as we know it today. No television, no radios, no cell phones, no coffee, no tea, no orange, no banana, no pineapples, no tomatoes, no paved roads as we know it. It was a poor place. No public toilets. And most white people did not bath. Just guess if you were there when you met them. I'm not sure how long you would have stayed there to stand them. They did not bath. That's the people we are talking about when we met. So they attacked Africa, enslaved Africa, which means they could do anything they want to do on any African person on our own land. That's what it means. And they took us in the Americas. They didn't take some of us. They took African people. This is really important to understand. Because the way history is given, they will say they took black people. No, they took our people. Us, you and I. Because we are historical people. You are not Africans today. You were Africans then. And any Africans in Africa or out of Africa remains an African person all the time. That is really important. So they took us in the Americas. They didn't put black people, some black people, they put you and I into slavery. And you need to understand, when we say they put us into slavery, it was a process you can barely begin to come to terms with. Every form of violence you see today was experienced during slavery. Massive killing of black people. It didn't start in Kibera here. It started during slavery. Massive killings. Because I read somewhere for one African that was captured, four died. Because it was known that Europeans came to Africa and there was a market where Africans were sold. You just go and pick and choose and put in slave ship. No. We were free African people. So you need to kidnap an African person because it was a free person. So it was an act of war. So for every African that was taken away, four died, many wounded. So you had blood everywhere. That's the process I'm talking about, because in the school books they would say it was trade. It was not a trade. It was kidnapping and killing and murdering and raping. They will kidnap Africans and march us from one place to another, sometimes for 3 months. And then we'll be kept in what they call castles that they build up along the coast from Senegal down to Mozambique, and kept there where African women will be raped at will. It was that process that created Europe we're looking at today. And in Americas, we have to work day and night. We have to produce. And we produce the whole wealth that changed Europe. Remember what we said, Europe was a poor place. As a result of enslavement of African people, so much wealth was produced. We were not paid. And we worked not for one day, not for 1 week, not for 1 year, for centuries. Can you imagine working for centuries and not being paid for centuries? And all this wealth is the wealth that transformed Europe. Transformed Europe. We need to understand that, brothers and sisters. Europe was transformed from a place that used to be poor. It became a place that became rich. It grew rich because we work and produce day and night for Europe. That's what slavery was about. We produce cotton. And cotton is what changed England. It's cotton that financed the industrialization for Europe. We produce tea. We produce coffee. We produce maize. We produce, you name it, for Europe. We build roads. We build houses. It's this unpaid labor, these unpaid resources that change Europe. Because capital, a boy in the beginning said, how many of you know about the word capitalism? Capitalism is the resources stolen from black people. This was capitalism about. So when you see somebody saying it's a capitalist, it's somebody who has a capital, he has resources, money stolen from our forefathers and mothers. That's what capital is. No, let anyone tell you it's the forces of market, stuff like that. That's your money, your resources. That's what it is. And also, you identify as a mosquito. A capitalist is a mosquito. Yes. It's somebody who has your blood. You could not be wealthy without killing, being a participant in a slave trade, in exploiting, in enslaving African people. That's what it is. A capitalist is somebody who is guilty of murder against black people. Yes. That's what a capitalist is. Because I know many of us, many young people, when you go to schools, they seduce you to be a capitalist. But they don't tell you the whole story. That's how a capitalist was born. He was born that way. He was born through enslavement of African people and murder and killing of African people. That's why Europe got its capital. That's why Europe is powerful. It's powerful because it has our capital. That's what we need to understand. So in this process of stealing our capital, stealing our labor and our resources, Europe grew very rich. Europe became from an economy where they used to do most of the work manually, by hand. So much wealth came to Europe that Europe qualitatively changed. It became a necessity to have a more intense way of production. You could not process all this cotton, all this tea, all this coffee, all this textile, all this material coming from Africa, from Americas, just by hand. You need a process that is more efficient. So industrialization became a necessity. That's how Europe moved into the era of industrialization. So with machinery, you can process cotton, all this raw material, more efficiently, more rapidly. This means that Europe did not need slavery as such, the way we understood it, anymore. Plus, the resistance to slavery increased sharply. You had rebellion throughout the Americas. So a combination of African resistance in the Americas and the enrichment of Europe made it necessary to change the system. So it became necessary now to have raw material to feed the industries of Europe. So from African labor that was needed, now they needed more African resources. Where will they go to get the resources? Of course, where they go to the labor in the first place. Yes. Africa, again, is the solution. That's why they had Berlin Conference. Instead of having white leaders, white nations fighting amongst themselves, they say, let's sit down and give everybody peace so we don't have to shed blood over this crumble for Africa. So that's on 1884 and 1885. They sat among themselves, the leaders of Europe, carved out Africa. You get that peace, you get that one, and they create all these new borders that didn't exist, as the chairman said before. There was no Kenyan before. There was no Togolese before. There was no Angolan before. They are all this new creation. Just as they create new nationalities, not just in Africa, in Americas. When Europeans went to Americas, there was no Peruvian, there was no Brazilians, there was no Americans. Right. There was no Jamaicans. They create these new nationalities, and they gave it to us. They imposed it on us. We used to live in the plantations in America, Central America, and South America. That's what I recognize. The unit of production was a plantation, a slave plantation. Now, the units of production is going to be the colonies in Africa, in addition to what exists already in Europe. So we became Kenyan, we became Togolese. In other words, colonies are a form of plantation, slave plantation. Instead of planting tea, cotton, but we're going to go in the mines, dig gold, dig cotton. So when someone calls me a Congolese, I understand what they mean by that. They mean a colonized person. They mean an African who is colonizing his own land. So when they call you Kenyan, they mean a part of Africa where Europeans are going to take the resources and the labor. So you colonize in that part of Africa. So it's a colonized person. That's your identity, colonized person. They call you Kenyans. And someone asks all Kenyans all 24 hours. See? So in this process, we begin to produce raw material. But as you know, oppression breeds always resistance. Just as we fought against slavery, we also began to fight against colonialism. Until the 60s, because I'm moving to the 60s, because around the world, there was a struggle for liberation everywhere. The 60s is characterized as an era of resistance by the oppressed and colonized people. So you had the struggles throughout Africa. As you know, those struggles produced the country, the state we know today. I'm going to go a bit faster because the struggle against direct colonialism or direct white power resulted in what we call, the chairman referred to, indirect white power or indirect colonialism, where the leaders became just people who look like you and me, who speak like you and me, who eat the same food like you and me. Just our own people became the leaders. That's the struggle we are confronted right now. How do you struggle in the conditions where the leaders are people who like you? Everywhere you look in Africa, the first line of oppression is represented by people who look like me. You don't see Europe, you don't see America. You first see people who look like you. And in most the places, the leaders in Africa always use what we call tribalism. They use ethnicism to say, you catching hell here because that tribe has taken everything. That's how it's portrayed. It's the fault of that tribe. But the reality is that 93% of the trade that happens between Africa and outside world happens between Africa and Europe and America and Japan and increasingly China. 93%. It means that if you say that in Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, for example, if you say the jewelers, for example, they're coming from the north, they're responsible of the misery of Africans, Ivory Coast, you're saying that 93% of the wealth from Africa is going to the jewelers. Is that the case?
No.
If you say, you take one place in West Africa, maybe in Sierra Leone, you say the Fula are the problems, or the Fulani, as some people refer to our people there, you're saying 93% of the wealth of Africa is going to the jewelers or to the Fulas, which is just a nonsense, isn't it? That's basically what tribalism does. It makes poor Africans believe that the other tribe or so-called tribe is taking everything, when in reality, tribalism is a cover-up for imperialism. You want to understand who is in defense of imperialism, who is in defense of Europe and America, theft of African resources, is a tribalist leader. Because he's misdirecting your anger from the real target to a target that suffers the same way, just like you. The Hutu and the Tutsi poor people suffer the same way. The Hutu people in the Congo, the African people in the Kenya, we all suffer the same way. And someone to come and say, is that tribal is the problem? You identify the same way who is in defense of imperialism. I'm saying this because we need to give you the basis for what we're trying to put out, why we need African Socialist International. We need to understand that the world system, as we know it, was given birth by enslavement. That's some of the things the enslavement of Africa did. Not only made Europe rich, but it creates a world capitalist system. And there is no way in the world you and I can be free if we don't bring down that world system. Because the world system requires you and I to be unfree, to be exploited, to be dominated 24 hours a day. When we are paid $1 a day, anywhere in Africa or in the Caribbean, when we are poor in the ghettos, in our housing states in the US, when we are poor in England or in France, because the world system functions that way. It functions with the labor, unpaid labor of African people and unpaid resources of African people. That's the condition for you to have the world market. I know in school they told you all those things about the market. But the market requires you and I to be paid less than a dollar a day. That's the market. That's the condition for the market to exist. So there is no way you can have a struggle for freedom if you don't deal with the market, which means deal with the imposition of the salary for $1 a day to our people. So our struggle is the struggle to overturn the conclusion, the verdict of imperialism, which is $1 a day for every African workers and peasant work. So the struggle is not what they have told us, because I know now they tell us the struggle is for democracy. Isn't that right? But they don't put on the table the world markets. They don't put on the table the unpaid labor for African people. It's not on the table. What they want you to do is choose for 1, 2, 3 candidates. But all the candidates are part of the games. It's the organization created by what we call indirect white rule. Anyone who agrees with that, they have their own organization. And they mobilize your vote. And we're saying we're struggling to bring capitalism down. And there's nothing wrong with that. Because capitalism is responsible for our misery. And capitalism was born as an act of genocide. So the struggle is the struggle to end genocide. How many people die, or how many people die today in Africa for not having food, for not having access to clean water? How many people today? For being beaten up by the police? How many people die in Africa today because of the malaria? There is no medicine. How many people die today in Africa because of the TB, because of AIDS? How many people? We die in millions every week, in millions every week. So the struggle is not the struggle to choose between one or two people or one tribe against the other. That's not the struggle we are involved in. The struggle is to end the genocide of African people everywhere on this planet Earth. Our struggle is a struggle to have a nation, as Chairman say, of our own. A nation of our own, where we are powerful, where we are stronger, where when we say you don't come to Africa, we mean it, and you can't come to Africa because we have the power to keep you out. Yes. That's what the struggle is about. We need to have our own nation, and we can't have that nation as part of colonized people. We have to be free people. As we said all along, all our nationalities are colonized nationalities, oppressed nationalities. You can't be powerful as a oppressed person. You have to be free. We have to come together, because you cannot end the world market economy as Somalian, as Ethiopian, as Zimbabwean. You can't. That's why they can impose sanctions on Zimbabwe, as they have done. Foods are leaving South Africa. Food, plenty of food, flying over Zimbabwe, coming straight to Germany and feed Germans. You go to England, France, grapes from South Africa, avocado, South Africa. Yes. You see a lot of fruits, beans from Kenya, tea from Kenya, flowers from Kenya. You see pineapples from Ghana, but we're starving in Zimbabwe, and they're showing that to us on the television all the time. Why? They say, you know Zimbabwe, you from somewhere else. But if you know we are one African people, one nation, you need this our food. If you know leave South Africa, Kenya, go to Europe, our food should go and feed our people in Zimbabwe. But you can't do that because you don't have control of your identity. And that's what we need to solve. We need to be one identity, one people, one nation. This is what the struggle is about. The struggle is not going to choose between Raila and Kibaki or somebody else, or between Kabila and Bemba in the Congo, or between Wade in Senegal and somebody else. That's what the struggle is about. Or like this week or next week, I think we're going to vote in South Africa between Zuma and somebody else. That's what the struggle is about. The struggle is we African people to be a powerful people, a powerful people. Democracy belongs to powerful people. You listen to television, they say, Rwanda now is a democracy. It's stable. They're just laughing at us. Democracy is for powerful people. In other words, they call it self-determination. You are the master of your land, master of your life, and master of your economy. That's what democracy is about. We can't be in voting for somebody, and then you see, you get in an airplane, Kenyan Airlines, you say, who runs Kenyan Airlines? They say, KLM runs it. We don't run KLM. You think the Dutch will allow you to run KLM? You go to Congo, you ask, what's this? This is mine gold. Can you believe it? Mine gold in your land. Who owns it? The Canadian owns it. Gold. You can't tell a white man there's gold in that car. You see that car there? You can't tell white people on the street that there's gold in that car. There will be a rush to that car. This is what's happening to us. We don't even recognize what is ours. Everyone is taking it. Everyone takes Africans for granted. Africans are nice. I was, you know, that's why people speak to us. I went to Tanzania. They are so nice there. I left Tanzania with their gold. That's how they speak. And we say, oh, yeah. We accept all this. IMF comes to Africa with £1 and gets out with £12 for every pound. And we call the IMF investors. What's wrong? Can't we organize a thief? Someone comes to your house with a pound and leaves with £12 and you call that person an investor? You're calling a mosquito an investor? Comes to your house, takes your blood, and leaves you sick. And you say the mosquito is an investor? You must slap the mosquito. You know how to slap the mosquito. You are firm and determined that mosquito should not leave this room alive. It's not what you do. That's what we do. And investors leave Africa smiling. You know, and that's what we need to change. So, I would just say one more thing is what we call opportunism. You know, they seduce us in schools. They teach us to love capitalism, to love our oppressors. They teach us to talk like our oppressors. You get much pride if you can speak like somebody in the BBC. People respect you because you've been to universities. Even the elders in the community call your boss. Say, this child is so smart. Just because you got a degree, that's not smart. I'm not saying you don't have abilities to get these degrees. You know, you got a right to study. Being smart is working to make Africa free. Yes. That's being smart. That's being smart. Putting a plan right here in Kenya to bring all our people together. That's being smart. When someone has a plan to get our people to kill one another, you bring your own plan to bring us together. That's being smart. So we say opportunism is a serious problem. in our community, in our organizations. Somebody joins the struggle, not to solve the problems of the masses, but to solve their own problems.
Yes.
The 60s was a glorious period for Africa and African people everywhere. There was a high expectation that we're going to be free and united. But the same people who used to lead the struggle, most of the time, end up being the ones who oppress us. Why? Because from the very beginning, our struggle was led by the people who do not produce value. We need to understand that the workers are the ones who produce value in society. A lawyer does not produce value. He can talk well, but he does not produce value. A doctor can treat us well. He does not produce value. It's the worker that produces value. Makes the chair. Agriculture workers make the tea, pave the roads, dig the gold. It's work. This is the basis of development of all human beings, the basis of development of all societies, the basis of development of language. Anything is based on work. No work, no labor, no society, no life. That's fundamental. And there is what we call a class of African petit bourgeoisie, a class created at the image of our oppressors. That class was created to be the middlemen and women between the people and the oppressors, between white oppressors and Africans, African people. Independence was given to them or was hijacked by them to maintain the world capitalist system, to maintain Africa chained to Europe. And it doesn't matter what you do, how many elections you're going to have. As long as that class, that group of people, control the economy, control the state, which means control the police, the army, and secret intelligence, all this, they control it, there will be no progress for our struggle. Because struggle, in a final analysis, is to give the workers, or for the workers to have access to their own power. That's what the struggle is about. But from the point of view of the African petit bourgeoisie class, the struggle is to keep the workers oppressed away from power. So they use the power to oppress and repress people. So people join the struggle. People create organizations to enrich themselves through capitalist system, as we've been saying all along, born at our expense. So if an African person wants to solve his or her problems using capitalist system, that person can only do so at the expense of all of us. That person can only do so by sacrificing our future for their own selfish interest. That's opportunism. Somebody will sacrifice the long-term interests of Africa. Somebody will sacrifice the dignity, the future for African people. Somebody will sacrifice the interest of revolution. Because we can't solve our problem without revolution. It's impossible. That's opportunism. And opportunism is rife in Africa. Rife in the organization. All organization is rife. So the struggle for us to be free, to be one, is a struggle against opportunism. We have to begin to require, to make a request of a principal relationship. If we don't do it, we will never be free. Because you will allow your brother, because he speaks the same language as you, to use the organization for their own selfish interests. You allow your friends, because you went to school, the same school. You allow, anyone you're familiar with, because you also want to make money at the expense of Africa and African people. So opportunism is something we need to begin to deal with. So the struggle for one Africa is a struggle against opportunism. Any struggle that does not recognize or is not tied somehow to one Africa, one nation, is an opportunist struggle. You can't free Africa as separate entities, it is impossible. Impossible. That's opportunism. Anyone who comes to say Gabon first, Congo first, that's opportunism. Because right now in the Congo, with 9 borders, every border around Congo is an imperialist border. If revolution rises up in the Congo, it will attack from the 9, it will be attacked from all those 9 borders. That's a reality. That's why you need the revolution in the Congo, the struggle in the Congo to be united with the struggle in Rwanda, Burundi, all 9 borders. So your back is safe because it's the same as you. Same trajectory, same objective, same goals. Build one Africa and one nation. That is fundamental. Don't make no mistake that the struggle in Kenya is separate from the struggle in the Congo. You need to know what's going on in Congo because it's your interest, it's your future that's being determined in the Congo right now. And what's happening in Kenya is also my future is being determined right now in Kenya. I don't have to be born here. Africa is one. Africa is one. And if we understand this, we begin to organize with this in mind, we know the liberation will come faster. And my last point is, many times people question, Africa's poor. The chairman already said that. Africa's not poor, remember? Africa's being looted. Africa's not poor. But they will say, where will you get the brain power? Do you know how many scientists from Africa are in America? Born in America, away from Africa for 100 years. You know how many scientists are there? Ready to come home? But you have to build one Africa, one nation. Because they are not Kenyans. They are not Zambians. They are Africans. They want to come to Africa. They don't want to come to Zimbabwe, but to Africa. So we've got engineers from Jamaica, from Trinidad, from Montserrat. Africa has the resources, don't we? Africa also has the brain power. We have the brain power. So that's two conditions. China has brain power, but Africa doesn't have, China doesn't have resources as Africa, but they have the brain power. What has China had? One leadership. And they go that through revolution. Africa doesn't have one leadership because we have not made the African revolution yet. That's what's missing. So we've got the resources, we've got the brain power. What is missing? The African revolution, the ASI is missing. You put all these three, Africa will be free, industrialized, and developed rapidly, and African economy will be the most powerful economy in the world. We can see it. We can see it. Only thing is missing is that ASI. So if you understand the urgency to build this organization, then we know this conference is a historical conference. I'll just stop here because I'm really glad to be here in Kenya. And one thing I would like to do is learn the language here. I think the time is short for that. And I'll just say thank you to you for the efforts to be here. And thank you once again to the sisters and brothers who put this event together. And, you know, I'm really excited to be here and I hope we're going to have a meaningful discussion about this. Can I just say one more thing? I should not leave this platform without paying my respect to Chairman of Maristel. You know, every struggle must have a leadership. There is no struggle without leadership. And I wouldn't be here if I didn't know meet is a leadership. We don't have Kwame Nkrumah today, Lumumba today. We don't have Dina Kemafi or Malcolm X. We have Chairman of Maristel. Yes. An incredible organizer, tireless fighter for one Africa, one nation. He traveled around the world. Since we didn't go to him, he's coming to us. Can you believe that? He's gone everywhere looking for people like you who agree with one Africa, one nation. And I think that's important to recognize that. Uhuru.
Yeah. Uhuru, you were just listening to a presentation made by Comrade Luwesi Kinshasa, the Secretary General of the African Socialist International, at the first East Africa Regional Conference of the ASI. we've come to the end of the program, Africa Live, here on uhururadio.com for today. But that's okay, because next up you have Uhuru on the Move. And I want to, before we close it out, say again, you know, to our listeners to be checking out Uhuru News and Uhuru Radio and staying up on what's happening with the newly formed National Committee of the ASI there in Nairobi, Kenya. Again, you know, we're in Kenya, not just Nairobi. Again, you know, as we said before, and as you heard in the interview, the government there has already begun to move to attempt to undermine our efforts there, undermine this process of uniting and liberating our Africa. And we have to be vigilant. We have to be prepared to defend our comrades there and, you know, help to push forward this process. So stay tuned here on Uhuru Radio. I'll be checking out Uhuru News to find out, you know, the latest on what's going on there. We will keep you abreast on what's going on there. You know, to support this process of uniting and liberating our Africa. This the establishment of the National Committee in Kenya is another step forward towards this in this process, and it's extremely significant. So we have to we want to again call on those of you out there listening to support this process, to support the work to build the African Socialist International, support the struggle to unite and liberate our Africa. This is it for Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. Next up, you have Uhuru on.
Academic freedom has long been more of a myth than a reality in the United States. Like so many freedoms Americans celebrate, it tends to fail the test when confronted with the larger public's freedom to exact vengeance against those it hates, and the freedom of large institutions to exclude those who question the role of those institutions from within. The political activist and ethics professor Ward Churchill's freedoms were negated earlier this year by a Denver district court that ruled he was not entitled to get his job back at the University of Colorado, even though a jury had earlier decided Churchill had been fired for his political views. There is no such thing as academic and political freedom if you can be fired for exercising it. Churchill's crime was in writing an essay the day after September 11th that tried to put the attacks in the context of U.S. foreign policy's effects on other peoples in the world. He used the term Little Eichmanns to describe some of the people who died in the World Trade Center. Not a very politic thing to do, but certainly not as harmful as what George Bush unleashed on the world in the aftermath, or the wave of racist, fascist-like assaults on anybody vaguely Middle Eastern-looking that continue to this day. Ward Churchill was made to pay for his impolitic political statements, despite his disavowal of organized terror and his admission that families of 9/11 victims might have been hurt. His real crime was in declaring that U.S. society, as well as the U.S. government, was no innocent victim, that imperialism is a system based on crimes and terror, and sometimes the superpower criminal gets terrorized back. In much, if not most, of the world, such opinions are thought to be self-evident. In the United States, they are broadly considered a kind of treason, beyond the pale and beyond the protection of the Constitution. Certainly, the Denver District Court mangled the Constitution in finding that Churchill did not deserve reinstatement or compensation for his lost professorship. To justify their decision, the court ruled that the university's Board of Regents had acted as judges in dismissing Churchill, and therefore their decision was beyond challenge. If that were true, the regents constituted a very strange court indeed, since they had collectively denounced Churchill before even formally examining his case. The district court also dismissed the fact that a real, legally constituted jury had agreed with Churchill that he had been fired for political reasons. But since the jurors only awarded him $1 in damages, the court believed it could get away with giving Churchill nothing. The law can't get any flimsier than that, which shows that academic freedom isn't just a fragile thing in America, it's broken. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Africa Live.
Today on Amalia Shetela Speaks, we bring to you a dynamic presentation made by African Socialist International Chairman Amalia Shetela to the Conference Against Genocide on October 25th, 1992 in Oakland, California. We present to you Chairman Amalia Shetela.
Soviet Union, which doesn't exist anymore, how can you debate that?
when you look at the so-called socialist state that used to be what is now called Russia again, it's clear that the so-called international white nationalist left community is in a state of severe crisis. When you look at how that has ramifications throughout the world, listen, sometimes the crisis appears to be our crisis because we see what the dirty Russians did to Vietnam. They have betrayed Vietnam. They walked out on them and left them fallen with the U.S. imperialism, and we see what they have done to do. So it looks like it's our crisis on one hand, but it clearly is not our crisis. It is a crisis for the left, because you can't be the left and do that too. You understand what I'm saying? The crisis is not our crisis. Vietnam's going to have some problems. Cuba's going to have some problems. And those other places which have been deserted by these forces are going to have some problems. But as we overcome these problems, what we need to do is develop real revolutionary forces that expose the nature of the so-called white nationalist left, even as it's occurred. So look, there's a crisis. This crisis is manifested also throughout this country. The split in the Communist Party USA, extraordinarily interesting split, based on differences around the Soviet Union, not around the fact that the CPUSA never took a decent stand around the struggles of the peoples living in the barrios in this country, do you understand? Not around the fact that the Communist Party USA never took a decent stand around the struggle of African people in this country, but around their position on Gorbachev and whether or not a coup should have happened in the Soviet Union. That's the basis for that split. That's nonsense. But it's a crisis. So, here we are. This crisis that manifests itself concretely and materially in the world, right? Whole states dissolving right before our eyes. Throughout Europe, mayhem, chaos everywhere, partially as a consequence of that and partially as a general crisis of imperialism itself, right before our eyes. But even as this has occurred, what we are seeing is now a coming together of real revolutionary nationalist forces. I say, I don't particularly like the term revolutionary nationalism, but what I'm talking about is peoples who are involved in struggles for national liberation, which is the essential question and has always been the essential question over the last 500 years. We, having these discussions today, are grappling with the fundamental ideological questions of the world, the fundamental ideological questions that will determine the future of the world. And I think that that's extraordinarily important that we should be here, because we have important tasks which are before us. So that even as we see a deterioration of the white nationalist left, we see a consolidation of unity of oppressed forces here inside this country and other places around the world. We have it within our grasp to define the future of the world if we're struggling and grappling with it in the best possible way, and if we have the ability to take ourselves seriously. And that is the fundamental question. Because we get taught not to take ourselves seriously, you see. In fact, that's the reason why we can't even have good relationships in our lives with our wives and with our husbands, etc., because we've been taught not to take ourselves seriously. The fact is that if I can't like me, I damn sure can't like someone just like me. And that's the thing that's been really put on us as oppressed peoples for a long period of time. But if we can take ourselves seriously, we can win. I think also that this place where we are now, grappling with the profoundly important ideological questions, is a crucial place, because the real ideological questions are just now being broached. In our communities, and perhaps even in the African People's Socialist Party, I can't be sure, in the Uhuru movement, perhaps, but certainly in the community in general, we've seen situations where we don't really take ideology seriously. You know, I mean, we learn it in a certain kind of way, in the same way you learn a good song,
You learn a good song, you really like the rhythm, you like the melodies, etc. But there are a lot of other good songs too, you know what I mean? They're like this song or like that song, it's just like a whole lot of songs. And in some ways, we have an ability to like a lot of ideologies. So today, I could be an African internationalist. Tomorrow, I could be a new Africanist, or I could be an Egyptologist, or whatever that piece of thing is all about. You know, and I know all of them. I know how to pray in Arabic. I know how, to wear the appropriate clothing, the entire bit. But ideology, if it's real ideology based on science, cannot be something that you put on and take off, like the latest dashiki that you might run into. Ideology, if it's really based on science, then gets to the kernel of the contradictions that we have in the world as human beings. It is a real examination of the laws of social development, and through which we've come to certain kinds of conclusions, so that all of our practice in the world will be informed practice, as opposed to just going out doing things because it feels good. That's what we're talking about today. With this discussion on ideology, we are really struggling. With this discussion on genocide, we are really struggling with profoundly important ideological questions. And that is also the fact that we are in an area of science is the basis. It's the basis of our being able to speak the same language. Listen, the reality is that all of our movements have gone through this process of having the white left teach to us and preach to us in a language we never could understand, even if they were speaking the same language that we spoke. In terms of, they spoke English, I speak English, I don't understand what the hell you're talking about. But what we see is that now that we get a grasp of science, so here we are talking about ideology, and Spanish-speaking comrades understand exactly what I speak, and I speak English and don't speak Spanish, etc. Because now science is at work, and we are peeling off these layers of mystery and superstition that's been handed to us for so long as representing real ideology, when it has been nothing to do with ideology based on science. You see what I'm saying? That's what we're saying. That's the basis for the ability of forces in Muyong and United Pride and the Uhuru movement to speak the same language. It is that it's based on an ideology based on science. Science then does what? It examines the laws of social development. Laws of social development. There's a universal component to this law. And that gets to the essence of every question. Religion, everything, has its origin in some fundamental questions. And the most serious, most fundamental of all these questions, the motive force of all of human society is what? The struggle to create and recreate real life. Everything else revolves around that. In the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God. And some nonsense like that, it couldn't have been. The struggle, how do you explain God? How do you explain the ideas in our head? You explain God and the ideas in our head by material reality. If you can understand material reality, you understand the origin of God. You see, listen to me. If you start from superstitions and fantasies, then you look to God to understand the origin of material reality. But what we want to say is, if you start with material reality, you get to the essence of it, you will understand the origin of God. What is the God that you think from the east or in the nature? Ideology is a crucial question. And if it's a scientific ideology, that's what we want, science, not superstitions, right? And it's not something you put on. So one day I'm a this, and the next day I'm a that. You know, and the thing is that we have to struggle really hard to take ideology to our people, to our movement, to really struggle for ideology, really struggle for science. So we want to talk about the genocidal nature of white power as capitalism. This discussion that we speak of very passionately. You heard Paul and Silas, he spoke of it very passionately. That's what the comrade was talking about last night. We had a little meeting here about the spirituality of the indigenous people, the spirituality of the African people. I'm very passionate about the question, but I'm not ruled by my passions. Haven't been since I was about 19. The point is that we can be as passionate as we need to be, and I think we should be passionate. But what guides us, what informs us, is ideology, is scientific approach to the question. So, on this question of the genocidal nature of white power and capitalism, what we want to do is take away some of the mystery of this question, essentially the mystery of the question of political economy, which has been passed around as a real mysterious something that we could never understand. You know, the Mexicans and the Africans can never understand political economy. The only one can understand political economy is white people, you know, who were particular certain kinds of schools, you know. But it ain't complicated. It really ain't complicated. It's so damn simple. In the beginning, certainly some 500 years ago, white people were poor. That's indisputable. White people were poor. White people were disorganized. White people were at war at each other. Little warring tribes all over Europe and the rest of them. And everybody else was cool. Indisputable. I mean, that's why Marco Polo was fucking around in China now. And then when you talk about let's go to an Italian meal, what you're actually going to eat Chinese, you know, because the noodles and the pastas and everything that the Italians claim, oh, that shit came from China. You know what I'm saying? The reality is that's why they was messing around, traveling everywhere on this looting binge that they were involved in. Because white people were poor and we were cool. It wasn't us who was going looking for Europe and said, dig up them holes and bring this gold and shit out of that. It was them coming here to look for stuff. You know, we're talking about turning history right side up. And then what we see as a consequence of their coming here and looting shit and stealing me and other people, we get poorer and poorer and they get richer and richer. That ain't f***ing complicated shit. You don't have to go to New York. They didn't quit, you know. They hooked up a whole system based on that. And they keep criticizing us for never trying to get ahead. You just can't get ahead. You know, they sucking our blood, and we can't get ahead. It's like Malcolm X said, they break your legs and then blame you for not being able to run. They break your wings and then blame you for not being able to fly. And this is the relationship that it's a material relationship. It's a concrete relationship that has been described by at different times by Marxism, by Marxist white people. Marx defined this phenomenon as primitive accumulation. The crank up, this thing that started up the whole shit. He said, this shit didn't start by himself. He didn't say it like that because Marx wasn't cool. I'm cool. This is the way the shit said. He said, this shit didn't just start by itself. he said that in order for it to happen, we had to have this thing that called something started up, primitive accumulation. That's what he called it. He called it putting the so-called Indians into the mines and shit and turning them into mines, bringing up the silver and gold, turning Africa into a warren for the hunting of black skins, the whole bit. He talked about the opium war fought against the Chinese by the British. All of this was a part of cranking up and start this whole damn thing. He didn't mention the French holding Vietnam and all, but that was a part of it as well. And so it was a whole brutal ripoff of the damn planet that took everything in Europe and took everything from us. And this is how he characterized it. Later on, because this relationship that Marx saw then had matured and developed to another place, Lenin spotted this shit. And he called it imperialism. And what did he call imperialism? He said, he gave it various kind of manifestations, but the essential aspect of imperialism was the oppression of nations by nations. He talked about monopoly and stuff like that, but that's just the development of what has been stolen over a long period of time. But the oppression of nations by nations didn't start when Lenin was born. Marx speaks this shit a long time ago. It started a long time prior to that. So here we have Europeans viewing this phenomenon and defining it based on how it impacted on Europe, not how it impacted on us, not how it impacted on Angola. You don't find a word about Angola in Das Kapital or any damn thing that Marx wrote. So, but it had a brutal impact on Angola. So, you have this kind of relationship that never went away. And the fact is that we've been fighting ever since. They've characterized these struggles, they've given it different names at different times, but the fact is that they have never been able to consolidate their domination and consolidate their rule. They have never been able to sleep easy. Never been able. And they have always defined our resistance as crimes and criminality. So, the point I want to make, though, essentially, is that in the beginning, we had Europe going out, creating a new world, if you will, through rape and through pillage. And as a consequence of shaping things, the so-called primitive accumulation, the stealing of wealth, and then there was another critical component of this thing. There were two related components to the so-called primitive accumulation. Now listen to me, because you're going to hear this again. The white left is going to begin to argue against what I'm saying, because they want to include, because every now and then, Marx or Lenin or somebody would include into the definition of what they call primitive accumulation, the so-called enclosures that went on down inside Europe. You mean what the enclosures are? It was an instance where the nobility began to rip off the land of peasants and things like that, and push them off the land so that they could not have the ability to make it on their own land. In order for them to function, they had to do what? They had to go to work for a rising emerging capitalist. But that's bullshit. You cannot include that as part of the definition of primitive accumulation. Even though Marx said it, even though Lenin said it. I'm going to have this discussion because the reality is that this is a discussion of ideology that we're having here. So I would hope just to mess with you for a second around this question. Listen to me. Here's what we have. The traditional Marxists have taught us that history moves in this vertical fashion, from the lower to the higher level of development. That's how it's characterized, as development. They have taught us that in the beginning, and they are wrong, by the way, in applying this reality to humanity in general, they are wrong. But in the beginning, what they said that there was primitive communism or communalism, where everybody just shared, no class contradictions, no private ownership of land and resources. People are shared collectively. As a matter of fact, as a point of fact, there's no evidence of such a thing as that ever existing in Europe. But this primitive communism, this communalism, the basis for this judgment came on studies that was done of the Iroquois Indians and some other African groupings. Then from this, we are to learn that because of certain contradictions do come about, transformation happens inside the society itself, and then out of this primitive communism or communalism, there's born a new society that is called slavery. Where there are contradictions, and the primary contradiction is one that exists between the slave owner and the slave master. Now, think about this, because when we think slavery, people in history, modern history, think of me. In fact, that's a generic term for black person today, right? Slave. But we're talking about Kirk Douglas, you know, as you know, Spartacus, you know, fighting the Romans and shit like this. This is the story they're talking about in terms of slavery. This is stuff the white people were doing to white people. Then contradictions out of this, according to it, lead us to this phenomenon that they know as feudalism, right? And that where the primary contradiction is between the landlords, the landowners, and the land and the peasantry. That's the basic contradiction. Then you know, up to now, all the development that we see in human society has come through the contradictions inside a particular social system. For example, according to them, out of communalism springs contradictions which give birth to slavery. Out of slavery springs contradictions which give birth to feudalism, right? Now they get to feudalism, and what do they have to do? They have to explain the arrival of capitalism. They don't say, out of feudalism sprang the contradictions which gave rise to capitalism. They say, in order for there to have been capitalism, there must have been this extraordinary occurrence that they refer to as the primitive accumulation of capital. You see what I'm saying? This time they got to step outside of Europe and the European experience and European contradictions to make this goddamn capitalism happen. Up to now, we see society develop according to the logic through some internal contradiction. When they get to feudalism, they say it's not the internal contradiction that gives us capitalism. Rather, it is the so-called primitive accumulation, the entering of the Indians into the mines of North America of the New World, and the turning of Africa into a warren for the hunting of black skins. So we see, we're not looking at something that the Marxists explain as happening as because of some kind of internal contradiction inside Europe, but because of Europe goes out, and that's true. Now, up until now, we've been messing around with the theory of the rise of capitalism, which is crazy, which is madness. It is the essence of idealism that we should be messing around with the theory of the rise of capitalism. Why is it the essence of idealism? Because we don't have to rely on the theory of the rise of capitalism. We know how capitalism came about in the real world. How did capitalism come about in the real world? If you never read Marx or heard of it, we know how capitalism got here in the real world, don't we? Listen to this. Here's a goddamn African sitting up there talking about the theory of the rise of capitalism. Here's a Mexican and shit who no longer speaks his own language. They're talking about the theory of the rise of capitalism. Why in the hell do we have to debate the theory of the rise of capitalism when the practice of the rise of capitalism we are so familiar with? You understand? That is the essence of idealism. You see what I'm saying? So, when we look at the rise of capitalism in the real world, we see that the rise of capitalism, it required two components, two related components. One, it required the so-called primitive accumulation, because that gold and the silver had to come from somewhere in order to transform Europe. If we had the time, we would talk on another panel a little bit about this, I guess. It transformed all of Europe just as if we were being transformed ourselves. So it took the resources from the rest of the world, shipped them into Europe. And the other component, the other critically important component, was the so-called slave trade, the trade in black people. Because capitalism was born as a world system, and it required a world economy for its rise. It was the slave trade that hooked the world up into a single world economy. Modern history itself, which is the history of capitalism, the rise of capitalism, and subsequent to that, has in part the most singularly significant aspect of it was the slave trade. Because this is the thing that hooked the world up into one economy. See, there had been people trading around the world with each other previously, but there had never been a single world economy until the slave trade. They taught this to us in school, something like the triangle of trade and that kind of shit. But the world was hooked up for the first time in a single trade, in a single economy. That's why Cuba is in trouble. Believe me, Cuba is in for a rough fucking period right now. Because there is only one world economy, and it's a capitalist world economy. Even after Lenin seized power in what was then Russia, even after the rise of the so-called Soviet Union, there was one world economy. It was a capitalist world economy within which some socialists had seized power and had fought for a little goddamn space that ran out on them by now. When you see Gorbachev and Yeltsin and George Bush under the covers in the bed doing something dirty. So, we got this requirement for the rise of capitalism. Now, I just want to say this other thing in relation to that. Because people like to talk about the rise of capitalism in these antiseptic terms. But the rise of capitalism, first of all, is the same thing as the rise of white power. Capitalism and white power rose together. And most Marxists even told us this is the beginning of nations. They said there was no such thing as nations before the rise of capitalism. That's what we talk. It is white people explaining their own fucking significance in the world. I'm telling you. And they said there was no such thing as nations. The reality is that the white nations of the world were consolidated as a consequence of capitalism, of ripping and looting the rest of the world. That's the reality in the real world. So when we talk about the genocidal nature of white power, that's what we say. The genocidal nature of white power is capitalism, not genocide as some spectacular thing that has happened every now and then. But we say that capitalism as white power is genocidal by nature, and that you cannot find a time in history subsequent to the struggle for the rise of white power and its actual occurrence where genocide has not been happening on a mass scale throughout the planet. You know what I'm saying? Bakri read the United Nations Convention on the crime, on the punishment and prevention of the crime of genocide. We want people to be able to leave here. We copied that so you can take it with you when you leave, because most people are not familiar with the convention. If you were, you see yourself in there. But that's not even important. Because nobody talks about genocide. When they talk about genocide, they don't mean no Mexicans. They don't mean no Africans. You understand? Now, and look at what these guys did to us. I mean, you know the stories. You know the noses, the mutilation. They cut off your noses. They pay $25 per scalp. And white people, they blame the Indians for scalping, right? They go out and they cut the damn scalp off. They were paid $25 a scalp to murder the indigenous people. That's how you prove that you were a good killer. You brought back a scalp and got $25 for it. Look at what they did. I'm talking about the lynchings and shit. See, it was different from war. Because war makes a certain kind, generally has made an assumption. People have gone to war. There were certain kind of assumptions of rules associated with warfare. Like you don't hear, generally speaking, of white people fighting white people who would catch another white person, pregnant white woman, cut her belly open, and spill the baby on. You don't hear of white people cutting out uteruses and making hat bands from other white people. You don't hear of them cutting out women's vaginas and putting them around their saddle horns and shit. This is the stuff they did to us. This is what they did to the native women as a whole part of the entire process. So you're talking about the rise. This is the part of what's been rather antiseptically referred to as a process of acquired primitive accumulation. Here we are waiting to be accumulated. You understand? I mean, here we are just waiting to be a goddamn accumulated and shit. So this is what we're talking about. Now, we can't even factor the number of people who were murdered in this process. I mean, just last year, the United States government killed 200,000 Iraqi Arabs just last year. Just boom, it took in 45 days, so 200,000 Iraqi Arabs dead. And just in the trip from Africa here, they killed at least 100,000 of us. And then we don't know the scores of millions of indigenous people from this hemisphere who are dead, who no longer exist anymore. This is a part of the process. But the question of genocide, we never hear of genocide until when? The 1940s. There was no such word as genocide until the 1940s. Why? Because this was an instance of white people breaking the rules and killing white people in a certain kind of way. This was the thing that happened in Germany, where white people killed ex-Germans who were now Jews and broke the rules. This was Hitler's crime. Doing to white people what previously white people had only been doing to Africans, Mexicans, Indians, Chinese, and the rest of us as a matter of course and right. So when we talk about genocide, talking about an incident in history where somebody came and killed 6 million people. Hell, King Leopold, who controlled the Belgian Congo, killed 10, 12, 20 million people just in the Congo by himself, alone. But there's no word called genocide until it happens to white people. There are whole groups of indigenous people, nations that don't even exist in the goddamn, they make a movie, The Last of the Mohicans. And shit. And there's no word for genocide. And when you say genocide has been committed against us, if you are Mexican, if you're African, it's all you're exaggerating. What you, how dare you? It's not even permissible for us to talk about genocide being committed. It's impermissible. So, we're not talking about something incredible, spectacular, a rare occurrence in history. We're saying in reality, white power and capitalism are historically genocidal. And I just want to say, again, that what we are talking about, while it may be something that is emotionally moving, ain't nothing wrong with that. I could have been declared legally insane when they kicked me out of the military as a youngster. You know, they kicked me out of the military when I woke up, you know. You know, I mean, you go around, because I was what they call a good student when I was in school. You know what I mean? I mean, which meant I was well-trained. You know, I was a tame nigga. You know what I'm saying? Farm hands, quick mouth. and for various reasons, you know, things happening in the world just brought all of this acknowledgement down on me. You know, our forefathers. I mean, how many times in my life can I use the term our forefathers? Talking about slave catchers. You understand what I'm saying? Talking about slave catchers, somebody who stole my culture, stolen my name, stolen my country, sent my grandmothers and parents off to other places into slavery and shit like that. And I'm talking about our forefathers. I'm talking about kids like George Washington and Thomas the Rapist Jefferson and all of these forces, you know. And then to wake up, to come to your senses on this, you know, you have to be restrained, literally, you know, and certainly that was the way it was with me, almost. So you can become passionate about it, but that's not the essence of the discussion. What we want to say is that there is a way to understand the world, and we have to continue to struggle for it. There is a way to have a scientific view of the world, and we have to continue to struggle for it. And I truly believe that the kind of unity that's emerging with the forces who are involved in struggles for national liberation, I'm particularly impressed with the relationship that's happening with the Mexican National Liberation Movement and the African National Liberation Movement as a consequence of the relationship with the forces and comrades who are here, that I really believe, again, that we have a tremendous grip on the future, struggle for ideological clarity, struggle for a scientific assessment of the world, struggle to share this scientific assessment of the world with our friends, with our neighbors, with the people in our movement, etc. Because if they can get the science, if Marx was right when he said this, he said, theory, when it grips the masses, is a material force. That once it grips the masses, a material force, and nothing can get in the way. But we got to give the theory, we got to go down as deep as we can into the communities, into the bowels of our communities with the theory, with the ideology, so they can understand what the hell this struggle is about. Because it's not just about being mad at the police or being mad at white people. Be mad at them if you want to, but you can't be sustained off just anger. You've got to have theory. You've got to have some kind of ideology. And once the community has that, and you know what? It ain't hard. You know, because once we give history, genuine history, a historical materialist assessment of the world and shit, we can unleash these forces. And I want to appreciate, again, being able to be here and for the presentations by Pumayela Paul. And I guess we're ready
to do questions, to comment. But what we're going to do now essentially is open up for panel discussion.
So they have to, we talk about working class, yeah. What are we talking about?
Precisely. See, that's the thing that I guess that that's, we have to establish control ourselves, yeah, of the definitions, yeah, right, that we're using. Because when I say working class, I do not mean what the classical Marxists, yeah, have meant by working class. When I say working class, what I'm referring to, not only, I'm speaking about it two ways. That Sherman likes to refer to also in terms of one, he likes to think of the proletariat as the most profound component. The proletariat is not just the working class, but it is a class conscious. It is a class conscious of its interests. Conscious of its interests. It is a social force that has become revolutionized, that is class conscious. But the fact is that we are talking about societies which are riven by class contradictions.
Yes.
So ultimately, we are talking about what class, what social force is the leading social force in society. Is there a leading social force based on its relationship to the means of production, based on its relationship to imperialism? Is there, in fact, a leading force? When I say a leading force, I don't mean just at the moment, but I mean an historical leading force. For example, if you look at the Chinese Revolution, the genius of Mao, in part, was the recognition of the significance of the peasants, not at the expense of the working class. The working class was a tiny sector, but historically, if there was going to be development in China, who was going to make that development? A working class that was going to grow larger and larger and become more conscious of its interests and conscious of itself, you know, struggling for its own interests, and proletarianized. So you got a force who at any given moment may be more capable of fighting than the quote-unquote working class. But as a social force, in particular when you look at Africa, where you have such a tiny so-called working class in the first place, all of it, absolutely, almost all of it tied to international imperialism in some fashion because Africa does not produce for itself. But to say that phenomenon and then say that it does not mean that the working class is a crucial force, I think is an error. It is not an error to say this working class is not a crucial force, and you can get more success from what is being, what Fanon was characterizing as a lumping. But when you look, when we use the concept of class struggle, recognizing class and social forces as playing historical roles in society, we don't just speak of the moment. We say, what role is this force going to play in history in building a new society? One. Two, when we say a working class, we don't just mean somebody's got a job. We're also talking about the whole sector of the population who, if it had an ability to feed itself, would have to do it on a job as opposed to being a boss, as opposed to being either the petty bourgeoisie or the big bourgeoisie. If it was going to feed itself and its family, it was going to have to sell its labor power in order to do that, essentially. Whatever other role that they play. We don't believe that, generally speaking, I would not use the concept lumping, not because I don't recognize in the African communities there are forces who play roles, social roles, similar.
Yes.
And I believe it's superficially similar to what was happening in Europe when Marx and people, you know, like that use the term lumping, but it has an entirely different thing. In African communities, even right here in Oakland, the forces, they had similar characteristics. They had similar problems in the sense that they represented similar problems to the movement in the sense that they would collaborate with the police because, you know, in order to be a prostitute on the streets, you got to have a relationship with the police. In order to live outside of the quote-unquote boundaries of the law, people often make deals and shit, but they were not like the classical European lumpen, where you had whole communities of people who were cast off and sometimes living in entire neighborhoods by themselves. But the so-called people who we characterize as lumpen live in the same communities we live in. They go to the same bars that we go to. Essentially, I mean, some people go to better, you know, better joints. Essentially a part, you know, of the community. But because we are a colonial population, which means we have no control over the employment of anybody in the goddamn community at any given time. You find huge sections of the population who have to do other kinds of things to live than what, you know, than participate in the process of production.
I agree with you, Kevin. Yeah. I was making trying to back there to get it, but I get it. But I was doing it from the standpoint, I think you heard this.
Yeah.
Of how the yellow pearl came about when you said, well, the yellow pearl belongs to you. That doesn't, or you love it, belongs to the so-called Marxists. That's the biggest way to get that terminology.
That's right.
We don't deal with put forth that terminology, and we use what's called the black masses or something.
Yeah.
We don't know, but what white male did you said has excelled at doing is always writing off statements of the black nation. Oh, that's just the Lumpen.
Yeah.
As the Lumpen is the term. And I'm saying, hey, the Lumpen belongs to you.
That's
and
right.
Your Lumpen,
right.
And then they're paying the what they did is, in all the hideouts of the revolution, they put on dresses and get out as happy as the women. That's what they did. Then how will we, and it's not even so big, but see, a lot of these people, I looked at the thing on that deal there about what's happening in Washington or Oregon up there. They got a thing on the ballot to strip them. I said, the hell with the sense of victory, because they have never stood for the black revolution or any struggle. They've always been stuck in the blood, wherever it is.
Yeah.
They've always stood that way. That's why that's the way it is.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I wanted to add to that, that, you know, one of the things with that characterization of love that they give to, I know they give it to Chicano, Mexicano people, they give it to a whole sector of our struggle, you know, and they do with African people. And one of the reasons they do that is that the white left is very ahistorical. I mean, you notice that it's been laid out here today. And one of the reasons that they never talk about the fact, for instance, that the reason we're so unemployed and quote-unquote lumpen is because there's a foreign force over here that's taking all the jobs and gives to this bloated working class. And so when I was talking about how they say that we're lumpen, you know, or that the rebellions were lumpen or whatever, what they're doing is they're starting from the point of 500 years later, this is the way it looks, because it's convenient to them. They would never have to do what the African People's Solidarity Committee is doing, which is go door to door and work hard and work under the leadership of African and Chicano Mexicano people to give back the resources. What they do is they start from their own self-interest, which we know the CPUSA has done since it was founded, and we know that the so-called Trotskyites have done, and even the so-called Maoists have done, act in their own self-interest to define things so it's not going to hurt them. And that's where the LA rebellions, you know, came out. That was the whole thing behind, you know, well, they're hurting the poor Korean merchants or whatever that is. And we know, you know, the chairman laid it out to us, what those and the Vietnamese and the Cubans and the Chaldean Iraqis and all these people are, and who they are, you know. And so, you know, that's something we've got to combat. We've got to combat, I think, the terminology that they use on the lumpenism, and also that whole terminology of, well, that's not united action, or that's spontaneous action, or they shouldn't burn down these buildings. You can obviously tell that when they're doing that, they have no understanding at all of what it's like in Nevada, or what it's like in the neighborhood, or whatever. Because what they're doing is they're taking the side of the most oppressor sector that we have. You know, one of the reasons that we don't see, in Logan Heights in San Diego, which is a lot like this area here in Oakland. In fact, it looks very much alike. You know, we don't see very many white people. We do see, you know, Arabs on every corner that are certainly not united with the struggle for the Palestinians, and we see Koreans who are sure as hell not supporting Kim Il-sung and the struggle against U.S. imperialism in Korea. So that's where it comes from. And, you know, when they try to say that, well, we're being racist or whatever that is, you know, that's a lot of bullshit, because those people and those sectors, you know, if you look at them, they're like any white nationalist, just a different color. And so, you know, that was more correct, I think, that people have a higher consciousness than a lot of people think when they went out and picked exactly those places to burn down and to take the resources back out of.
I just want to make one comment in unity with what Paul said in terms of the white left, when it makes this characterization of delegitimizing the struggles of the people like in Los Angeles who are rising up and is protecting what they assume to be their own self-interest. It's uniting with imperialism by criminalizing, if you will, the people who are involved. These are not legitimate forces. That's what they're saying. But they're saying until white people get ready to pick up the gun and do some shit like that, there's nothing legitimate until, you know, or until black people get ready to do it under our leadership, there's nothing legitimate about it. Because the thing is, what they struggle for, what they struggle for is to maintain control of our possessions. And that's the real deal. And so when we rise up struggling, they have to delegitimize it in the same way George Walker Bush did it. In the same way Gates did. You know, they function in the same fashion. And I think we have to lose any kind of romantic notion that there's that this white nationalist left is valid and that it has a consciousness that's essentially different from white people in general. It doesn't, you know.
Chairman O'Malley, during your presentation, you said that you were I don't recall what term you used, but you said you were uncomfortable with the term revolutionary nationalism. I'd like to hear more about more specifics. And number two, I'd like to hear, given your druthers, what theme would you like to see the African and the Chicano movements work toward?
I'm uncomfortable with the term revolutionary nationalism because I'm uncomfortable with the black nationalism in a certain kind of way, because I see it as being extraordinarily limited. I think that for a long time we tussled with this question inside our movement, and I believe it was the Black Panther Party who raised up the concept of revolutionary nationalism to distinguish itself from that other shit that was out there, that black nationalism, which was race, was essentially race nationalism. And race nationalism is backwards. It's right. Super backwards, no matter, you know, who practices it. So we are internationalists. And the question that was happening, though, was that most of the people who concept internationalists was liquidating the national interests of African people, right? So they would say, well, we're internationalists, and the white left was always telling us we had to be internationalists. Therefore, what they meant was that we had to be white nationalists. That was what they really meant, that you have to liquidate your interests as a people and just do this shit as a worker. You know, like the white left would never accept us as African people who were oppressed. You can't struggle. That means that you're struggling for the shit that they got. If you're struggling as an African, if you're struggling as a Mexican, you struggle to get your shit back from there. So you cannot struggle as an African or a Mexican. You got to struggle as a worker, right? And that means all of us are together, and we all gonna have your shit. If you get lucky, you can get some of it too, but only as a worker, right? So the movement reacted to that, and in a certain kind of way, because the reality is that the bourgeoisie was oppressing us as a people, as a national entity. That was the basis. So we call ourselves nationalists, and we were fighting for the national rights of our people. And I think that's just. I think we have to fight for our national interests. But I think that we have to be careful not to be race nationalists, as most of the nationalist movement was. Let me tell you this. During the era of Marcus Garvey, listen, we're talking about 1920s, etc., nobody was unclear. Our movement was on the offensive. Garvey was what he called an African fundamentalist, but there was no lack of, he was not a race nationalist. I mean, Ho Chi Minh actually literally attended meetings at Garvey's, what was the center called? Liberty Hall in New York. And the Negro World was effectively the political organ of Sandino on the Atlantic coast in Nicaragua, and the fucking Somocistas were so stupid that they only checked stuff coming in Spanish, right? And so, but Garvey's was printed, stuff was printed in Spanish, English, and France, and they wouldn't write anything bad about the government in Spanish, they'd write it all in English. And the people and Sandinistas were able to have benefit of that. That was no race nationalism. He was struggling for national liberation, not some racial shit, you know, which will trap you and kill you, because then you cannot understand Wilson Good if you're a race nationalist. You cannot understand these Negroes downtown, these f***ing dogs, puppet niggas downtown who suck the blood of black people if you're a race nationalist. So that f***ing nationalism
is a certain kind of problem. So the Panthers call themselves revolutionary nationalists as a way of actually putting forth internationalism. But we say that we are internationalists, we are African internationalists, which means that we are African people. We don't abdicate who we are. We don't abdicate the fact that we are struggling to liberate Africa and the African people wherever we are on the planet Earth, nor that that's the central feature of our struggle, but we are also internationalists. That is to say, and can have relationships, decent relationships, great relationships, revolutionary relationships with other peoples regardless of their nationality. Let me tell you what I mean. So I want to be clear. Not just some hypothetical but at different critical times in our movement, when we've seen other forces on the cutting edge of the revolution, we turned all our resources over to them. When the Nicaraguans were, when the shit was happening in Nicaragua, and they were on the cutting edge of the question, we turned over our printing equipment, and we did all kinds of shit. That was internationalism. That didn't mean we were liquidating our interests as a people, but we know these suckers, they're going to give imperialism a fit. If we can help them, we can kick them in the nuts. Like that, man, let's kick them in the nuts with the Nicaraguans. We'll kill this motherfucker. You understand? If the Nicaraguans got him down, let's jump on it. True. You know, and that was our position. And that's a whole kind of internationalist kind of thing. The theme I would be working on is a genuine anti-imperialist front. With the Mexican National Liberation Movement, with the other indigenous peoples right here in this country, a genuine anti-imperialist front where we began to define the ideological questions and practical tasks of these times in a fashion, and then, you know, and even began to do united actions and stuff so that we really raise up the struggles for national liberation to the predominance that they need to be. That's the kind of stuff that I would like to see happen.
You were just listening to Chairman Omali Eshetela speaking at the Conference Against Genocide on October 25th, 1992 in Oakland, California. That concludes Omali Eshetela Speaks for today. Stay tuned for...
Oh, still the philosophy which hold one race superior and another inferior is fine.